Blog Talk Radio.
You don't want to make an enemy of me, Barbie.
Blog Talk Radio.
Two sides of that coin, Jim.
You are listening to a pre-recorded interview from the archives of Prophecy Keepers Radio.
Hosea.
You have been led by the Spirit to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a cooperative service of the White Roots of Peace Council. Whether it be the modern Asaga of Peru, the current Kahunas of Hawaii, today's medicine people of the Americas, the Holy Ones of Africa, shamans of the East, North, West, and South, or the present-day Atawehis of the Cherokee, we bring you the traditional elders and teachers of our modern times and their confidants from the Americas, the steppes of Asia, the Holy Land, the islands of the sea, Africa, and Australasia. We have not been conquered, and we defy the established order. This is Will Bluewater, the host of Prophecy Keepers Radio, speaking on behalf of the White Roots of Peace Council.
It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's the 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's the 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow?
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. This station's only means of support is through donations and purchases of the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library, which includes lifetime online access to a printable 1,000-page intelligence briefing and a worldwide indigenous prophecy encyclopedia. Now, folks, there's nothing else like this collection on the planet. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files and 222 folders. It includes the Prophecy Keeper's Prepper's Self-Reliance files and all of our previous over 100 Prophecy Keeper's interviews. So head on over to prophecykeepers.com right now and have a free sneak peek today of two-thirds of the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and a peek of the dashboard of the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault. Osio Ginalii Tahiju Toigu, which means, hello, cousins. I'm fine. How are you? This is your old buddy Bluewater coming to you from the Cumberland Plateau in east central Tennessee. The ancient home of the Aniuntikwalaski, the people of the lightning and thunder, or the military protectors of the old Cherokee Nation.
Well, hello everybody, this is Blue Otter coming to you from the Missouri Ozarks and Booger County. That's a special area down in the Ozarks, three counties that are known for all their mystical properties and kind of a strange place, and we're down here in Kabul, Missouri. Our guest is Mike Kuzma. It's a special interview. Prophecy Keepers are going to get a little bit into politics, but you know what they say about political leaders or spiritual leaders also. And I'd like to introduce Mike Kuzma. Mike is Leonard Peltier's lawyer. And Mike... I couldn't possibly give you a better introduction. Go ahead and say hi to the folks. And
oh, hi, and thanks for having me on the show today.
You bet. Our pleasure. Well, I understand, well, for those that aren't familiar with Leonard Peltier, I suppose if you're Native American or American Indian, you know who Leonard Peltier is. He was falsely accused of a crime of killing two FBI agents back in the mid-70s. And he and two others, as I recall, fled to Canada. The other two were tried, and they were found not guilty or escaped. They got off. But Leonard, I guess, was extradited on the promises from the U.S. government. Isn't that correct? That go ahead and fill in the blanks here, because
Yes, there was a shootout in Pine Ridge, South Dakota, and actually a firefight on June 26th of 1975. And as a result of this firefight, Joe Stuntz, a Native American, and two FBI special agents were dead. Special agents Ron Williams and Jack Kohler. Leonard, rather than stay in South Dakota, left the area because he didn't believe he could get a fair trial in South Dakota. He left and was later apprehended in Canada, actually on February 6th of 1976. Leonard was arrested along with an individual by the name of Frank Blackhorse. Leonard was extradited from Canada to the United States, and Mr. Blackhorse was never extradited to the United States. And what's interesting is when Mr. Blackhorse was arrested in Canada, he had marijuana in his possession and a firearm in his waistband. And he was also wanted for shooting an FBI agent in March of 73. He had actually skipped bail. So what happened was Mr. Blackhorse was not charged in Canada with the firearm violation. And for those who might not be familiar with Canada, that is it's a serious offense today and was a serious offense in 1976. Mr. Blackhorse was merely charged with the marijuana violation, which he beat on a technicality. And guess where Mr. Blackhorse is today?
Free.
He's a free man in Western Canada. And that's even better. Frank Blackhorse isn't Frank Blackhorse. He's Frank Leonard DeLuca from the Chicago area. So that's one of the mysteries of this case. But Leonard was actually, getting back to Leonard, was extradited to the United States. The United States agreed not to seek the death penalty in Leonard Peltier's case. He was extradited primarily on the basis of affidavits provided by a mentally unstable woman by the name of Myrtle Poorbear. The government offered three affidavits from Myrtle Poorbear. She was pretty much forced into signing these. The government initially prepared one affidavit. The Canadian government said this was not enough. They offered yet another affidavit. And if you compare the three affidavits that were actually offered to the Canadian government, they contradicted one another. It was clear that this woman had been coached and hadn't given these statements of her own free will.
And anybody who lived on Pine Ridge during that period would have been mentally unstable anyway, because all the unsolved murders that was going on at that time. But so it was a real circus. People don't know. It was a war zone.
Oh, it was. Yeah, it was just awful. But the just to, one thing you might add to the Myrtle Poorbear story is that if you look at the 302s, which were prepared by the FBI agents who interviewed Myrtle Poorbear, 302s are prepared by FBI agents after they interview a subject. And there's several 302s that we've gotten from the FBI under the Freedom of Information Act. And if you look at those and compare them to the affidavits, it was clear that this woman was pretty much making it up as she went along. I mean, everything contradicted one another. It was clear that this woman was not a credible witness, but nevertheless, the FBI used Myrtle Poorbear in order to gain or get Leonard returned to the United States. And once Leonard was returned to the United States, he was tried in 1977 in North Dakota, Fargo, North Dakota, before the so-called Honorable Paul Benson, who's now deceased. And contrary to popular belief, Leonard's actual trial attorney was not William Kunstler. It was actually an individual by the name of Elliot Taketh, who was from New York City. He's now deceased. He died in Ecuador several years ago. There's no record of his death, but Mr. Takeoff agreed to have the trial moved from South Dakota to North Dakota. He actually consented to that. But my role in the case, there's several attorneys involved in Leonard's defense. Bruce Ellison, who's in Rapid City, South Dakota, has been involved in Leonard's case from the onset. I like to refer to Bruce as the case historian, if you will, and he's a valuable resource based on his knowledge of the case. Also, Barry Bachrach, who's out of Worcester, Massachusetts, is involved in the case, Ramsey Clark, and yours truly. I'm focusing primarily on the freedom of information aspect of the case. And just for your listeners, the Freedom of Information Act is a federal law that was enacted in 1966. The law was strengthened under the Ford administration, actually over a Ford veto, but the law was weakened under President Reagan, and President Bush has done everything in his power to make it that much more difficult to utilize the law. But the Freedom of Information Act, or FOIA for short, allows any person to request any record from any federal agency, and you do not have to give a reason for why you want the records. Now, a request, you don't have to have any kind of special form. You could simply send a letter to an agency and request certain records. The agency, in turn, may charge copying fees. Ordinarily, they're 10 cents a page. And in theory, the federal agency has 20 working days to release the sought-after material. Now, there are a number of exemptions in the law that an agency may invoke, however, they don't have to. These exemptions are permissive. For example, there's an exemption B1 that allows the government to withhold information that would be harmful to the national security. There's another exemption B7, and that's the law enforcement exemption. A federal agency such as the FBI may withhold records if, for example, it would compromise an ongoing investigation.
Or a confidential informant.
They use the term confidential source because both the statute and the courts have given the term confidential source a very broad meaning. It doesn't just apply to the Fink or whatever. It applies to corporate sources, say, for example, the phone company, or the bank turns over information regarding an individual, that entity may be considered a confidential source. So what we've been doing with FOIA in Leonard's case is we've been trying to secure records from the FBI relating to Leonard's case and its investigation of the killing of agents Kohler and Williams. Now, the official name given to the investigation was Resmers, which is short for Reservation Murders. And when Leonard was tried in 1977, the government, or the prosecution, turned over roughly 3,500 pages of material relating to Leonard Peltier / Resmers. And the government has an obligation. There's something called the Brady Rule, and the government, there's really no, should be no secrets or surprises at the time of trial. The government has an obligation to turn over whatever they have to the defense attorneys. And at the time the trial occurred, the government produces roughly 3,500 pages of material, and unless you have someone on the inside telling you, hey, the government isn't telling you the truth here, you have to take the government or the prosecution at its word. So Leonard's tried and, you know, had no reason to believe, you know, he could have suspected all he wanted, or his attorneys could have suspected all they wanted, but they assumed that's all there was, 3,500 pages. Leonard's tried and convicted, and you know his appeals were pending and such. And in the late 70s, early 80s, John Privatera, who's an attorney who's now based in Albany, and Michael Tiger, another attorney, submitted a Freedom of Information Act request on behalf of Leonard Peltier to the FBI and Justice Department. And as a result of that Freedom of Information Act request, we learned that the government actually had 18,000 pages of material relating to Leonard Peltier and Resmers. And the government,
you think you could get a new trial just based on that fact alone?
The sheer volume. Unfortunately, the courts don't see it that way. You have to show that the material is exculpatory in nature, in that the jury would have reached a different verdict.
You got to read 12 minds.
I mean, it's crazy. I mean, the courts have made it extremely difficult. I personally believe the sheer that number of pages alone would have warranted a new trial. So the government, as a result of the Privatera Tiger requests on Leonard's behalf, the government released 12,000 pages in Fuller and Park, and they withheld 6,000 pages in their entirety. And the government argued that they couldn't release these 6,000 pages because it would jeopardize national security and what have you. So fast forward to June 2000. I mean, from the time John Privatera and Mike Tiger made the request, people just assumed, okay, there's 18,000 pages. And for years, supporters of Leonard Peltier were lobbying Congress and such, urging them to force the FBI to release these 6,000 withheld pages. So we can fast forward now to June 2000. Jennifer Harberry submits a new round of FOIA requests on Leonard Peltier's behalf to the FBI and various other agencies. And the FBI, along with some of these other entities, give Jennifer the royal runaround. In the summer of 2001, I was asked to sort of pick up where Jennifer had left off. So we submitted new requests. We supplemented a request to Minneapolis, and we made requests to various FBI field offices around the country we thought would have records relating to Leonard Peltier and Resmers. And as a result of these requests, we learned that the Minneapolis office has 90,000 pages of material, and the Minneapolis office is especially important because that was the office of origin, meaning that the investigation was based in Minneapolis, and those records would be the most important because the Minneapolis office would have like raw investigative notes and that type of thing that you wouldn't find, for example, in the headquarters file. In addition, we had submitted requests to Denver. We found out there were records there. We submitted requests to Portland. Portland claimed that the file, their file on Leonard, was destroyed. Phoenix, we requested records from them. They had records. Pretty much every office we sent the request to, they said they had records. And what the various FBI field offices did was to refer our requests to Washington for processing. So all our requests are forwarded to Washington, and lo and behold, out of left field, we get a letter from Washington saying we are not going to process these requests because Leonard has an unpaid copying bill dating back 20 years, and he owes the FBI $1,200 some odd, so they just arbitrarily closed these requests. So I talked to John Privatera, and I said, do you recall ever receiving a bill or invoice for the copies that you got, you know, in the early 80s?
Or the 12,000 pages ago that were supposed to be copied.
So, John John was under the impression that, number one, that the documents had been provided gratis, and he had never been invoiced. So what we did is, after we received this bill, I contested the validity of the charges. The FBI never responded. I believe I did a second or third follow-up. And rather than waste or lose any more time, we paid the $1,200-some-odd under protest.
I'll see you. Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
There is a growing movement of people who are deciding to make their lives better. At LifeVantage, we're in the business of change, of improving quality of life globally and restoring the ability to make dreams a reality. Your quest for personal fulfillment begins here. Our flagship product, Protandem, the Nrf2 Synergizer, is the key to fighting oxidative stress. This daily supplement, comprised of natural ingredients, activates the body's antioxidant enzymes to eliminate free radicals, which cause oxidative stress. Protandem has been tested in the laboratories of renowned universities such as The Ohio State University, LSU, and the University of Colorado, Denver. These studies found on PubMed.gov, the U.S. government's online scientific library, clinically show that Protandem reduces oxidative stress.
When I saw that Protandem reduces oxidative stress by 40% in 30 days, I was all in for the rest of my life.
Everyone begs us for science as an industry. Where's your proof? Well, we have that also.
LifeVantage is devoted to advancing Nrf2 science and leading the fight against oxidative stress.
It's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now.
So we, the FBI got our payment and said, okay, we're going to start processing these materials. And in the, it would have been the, I believe, the spring of 2002, out of left field, I get a call from an individual by the name of Lauren Shaver with the FBI. And he wants to cut a deal on our FOIA request. He wanted us to greatly reduce the scope of Leonard's FOIA requests, and they would process whatever we would agree that we wanted. They would process immediately, and then we would have to agree never to submit another request to the FBI. You know, I said, well, yeah, I got to talk to some of the attorneys and such. So we ended up, John Privatera, Bruce Ellison, and I had a conference call with this Lauren Shaver, and he was literally a hostage negotiator. And in this instance, the hostage, or actually hostages, were the files that were maintained around the country relating to Leonard Peltier and Resmers. So we didn't have a clue what the FBI might have had. So we asked for a description of what the various field offices had, and the FBI said, okay, we can give you a brief summary. And among other things, I asked if they could tell us what field offices had records and which ones didn't, and Mr. Shaver indicated that he couldn't do that. We would be required to submit FOIA requests to each and every field office in the country on Leonard's behalf. So we did just that in November 1st of 2002. And what we discovered as a result of these requests is that, with the exception of one or two field offices, every FBI field office in the United States, and there's 56, has a file on Leonard Peltier or Resmers. So the government, we now know the government has 142,579 pages of material that have never been reviewed by Leonard Peltier or his defense attorneys.
High work.
It's unbelievable.
Did
did you
say 5,000?
Yeah. So it's 142,579. So keep mind, at trial, the government said we only have 3,500 pages. So I'd say that's a far cry from what was originally turned over at the time of trial. And another interesting thing we learned is the New York City file is missing. And that file is of particular interest given the fact that most of Leonard's attorneys are from Manhattan. William Kunstler was from Manhattan, Elliot Takeoff, Ramsey Clark, they were all from New York City. And lo and behold, that file is nowhere to be found. It's the government put it on special locate.
Probably because it had all the illegal wiretap stuff they were doing on Kunstler. And
undoubtedly. I mean, how does something like that just disappear? In fact, the a representative from that office called me, and they assured me it was in the building somewhere. So I don't know if it's being used to hold a door open or as a footrest, but it's there somewhere. But I mean, just for your listeners to give you some examples of how many pages we're talking, let's see. I mean, Anchorage, Alaska has a file, 80 pages. We have Boston has nearly 1,100 pages. Chicago, 2,500 pages. Denver has close to 2,700 pages. Los Angeles, 2,300 pages. One file has been destroyed. Let's see, Miami, 200 pages. Omaha, 2,861. Oklahoma, 2,075. I mean, the numbers are just mind-boggling. So we have these requests pending, and the government claims because of the large volume of documents relevant to these requests, coupled with the fact they're getting thousands of requests from people around the country, the FBI claims, you know, they can't process this material, you know, in a reasonable period of time. So what we did is, we decided, and the law provides for this, we decided to sue the FBI on Leonard Peltier's behalf in the U.S. District Court for the District of Minnesota, and we filed suit there in November of 2002, and we sued for the Minneapolis file and the Chicago file. And as a result of that suit, we filed our complaint, and the government responded, and they asked for what they call an open America stay. And what they wanted the court to do was to stay the case or have it held in abeyance until the FBI could get around to processing the resumes or Leonard Peltier file.
Sure, give them another 20 years.
Yeah, so the government said that it's, you know, in spite of all their efforts and all the personnel they've devoted to FOIA requests, that they couldn't even get the Minneapolis file to us until December 2005. Now keep in mind, Jennifer Harberry's original request was submitted in June of 2000. My supplemental request was submitted the following summer in 2001, and the law in theory says they have to turn over this material within 20 working days. So the government puts in this response. Barry Bachrach and I flew out to Minneapolis. We argued the case in March of 2003, and lo and behold, the court said, you know what, the FBI's trying real hard, so I'm going to grant them that extension of time. However, the government will have to make reports every 4 months showing what progress they're making on the processing of the Chicago and or the Minneapolis files. And we do have the Chicago file that We did get that. That amounted to about 2,500 pages, and processing is supposed to begin on the Minneapolis file starting in December of this year. In addition, so that suit, the government is, you know, makes its report showing what it's doing to speed these requests along. In addition to suing the FBI field offices in Minneapolis and Chicago, in December of 2003, we sued the Buffalo field office of the FBI in the U.S. District Court for the Western District of New York. And we filed a complaint in December. The government filed an answer, and they released 797 pages in full or in part. They're withholding 15 pages in their entirety, and the government's arguing that they can't release some of this material because it would hamper the war on transnational terrorism. And they're also claiming it would divulge the identity of a confidential source. On September 13th of this year, 2004, we argued before United States District Judge William M. Scretany, and the government basically put forth that argument that they can't release this material because of this so-called war on terrorism, and you know, they're just parroting that the post 9/11 hysteria.
Any excuse will do.
So the case locally here in Buffalo got a lot of favorable press. The Buffalo News did a nice write-up following the oral argument in district court. Associated Press picked up on the case, and the current edition, the of People's Weekly World, has a nice story on the Buffalo case and what's happening on the Freedom of Information Act front. But what's especially interesting with the Buffalo file is there's one teletype here, and it's to the director of the FBI, and it's from Richard G. Held, and it was dated July 7th, 1975, and it's heavily excised, and it's has to do with a confidential informant, and this teletype makes it appear that this informant was advised by the FBI not to get too close to Leonard's defense attorneys. Now, I argued strenuously in federal court before Judge Scretany that this teletype should be released because FOIA exemptions cannot be used to protect illegal or unauthorized investigative tactics. So we believe this teletype might show that a source, although the FBI said, hey, you know, don't get close to defense attorneys, that's like a nod and a wink.
Uh-huh.
And we think something like this could potentially get Leonard a new trial, because something like that, where a source had compromised attorney-client communications, would definitely get the attention of the courts.
Uh-huh.
And possibly get Leonard not only a new trial, but his freedom pending, you know, scheduling of that new trial. Now, the FBI has a history of infiltrating or having spies get near the defense team. The American Indian Movement, which Leonard was a part of, had been infiltrated by an individual by the name of Douglas Durham, and he was a former cop from Iowa. He, at the direction of the FBI, infiltrated AIM, the American Indian Movement, and became so trusted within the American Indian Movement, he actually became the head of security.
I was going to say, it may have been security.
I mean, it's wild. And
yeah.
What's intriguing is Durham, Dennis Banks, who was a leader within the American Indian Movement, was standing trial, and Douglas Durham was able to determine who could, you know, come and go, who could see Dennis Banks. He would be sitting there while the attorneys were speaking with Dennis. And what's intriguing is Durham, when he was testifying before a Senate committee, he eventually went public and went on this speaking tour on behalf of the John Birch Society and such. He claimed, though, that whenever attorneys were talking with Dennis Banks, he sort of tuned out and didn't tell the FBI anything.
Mm-hmm.
So the FBI, with respect to the American Indian Movement, does have a history of sending in, you know, infiltrators to disrupt, monitor, and harass targeted, you know, individuals and organizations. So I'm very, very optimistic about the Buffalo case, and I believe the Buffalo case, coupled with some of the other things we're doing, you know, will ultimately result in Leonard's freedom from federal prison.
Well, that sure would be nice. I know he sure. It's just absolutely amazing to me that you know, most people probably think, well, they're in prison, they're being taken care of. I mean, they let his teeth and everything get so bad. And you know, I talked to one guy, his name was Scott Weekly, and he was a friend of Bo Greitz, and you know, there were some political repercussions after they attempted to rescue MIAs. But I guess Scott did a stretch at Lompoc, and because he was a smart guy, they put him in charge of all the dental work in this facility, you know?
Okay.
You know, I mean, it's just, people have no idea what goes on in these prisons. And matter of fact, he got so so good at he was able to put on a seminar at one point about how to do dentistry under primitive conditions, you know, for people that might be concerned that they might have to do some such a thing in the future. And but yeah, people have no idea about how poorly prisoners are treated, they just assume that better things happen in prison than really do. And the general state of Native American religious rights in prisons is just absolutely shambles, especially in the state of Ohio. And I don't know, it's really weird. You know, they pass these laws, and the laws have no teeth, it's really, really kind of sad.
So, well, just to touch briefly on legal visits and the federal prison system, especially Leavenworth, I visited Leonard on three separate occasions, and, you know, I've been to some of these New York State prisons, Attica, for example, and when I conduct legal visits in Attica, I'm given a private room, and it, you know, I can exchange legal papers and such, and we have some privacy. I mean, I don't doubt the little visiting room at Attica is bugged, but at least we have a closed door and what have you. When you go to visit Leonard, the first thing they do is, and this applies to everyone, attorneys and non-attorneys, you have to be photographed. They actually prepare a mugshot of the attorneys with all your vital statistics and such. So you're photographed going in. Your legal visit is conducted in the regular visiting room, which isn't very spacious. You have to sit on this horrible, this plastic,
yep,
cheesy lawn furniture. There's several guards in the room. There's cameras. You have people conducting visits with grandchildren and such. There's no privacy whatsoever. You're whisked out of the visiting room at 3 o'clock. It's really a horrific situation. And you really, if you have anything that you want to discuss in confidence, you can't, because you have the guards there, the camera, the visiting room is undoubtedly wired. So it's a real ordeal for any attorney conducting a visit with Leonard Peltier, or anyone else for that matter who might be incarcerated at Leavenworth.
OCO.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Friends, this is Will Bluewater. Would you think twice about defending yourself or a loved one from an intruder? In this day and age, would you dream of leaving your doors unlocked at night for fear of being burglarized or even attacked or worse? Would you? But when it comes to our own bodies, the doors to our houses are wide open all the time. The very air we breathe and the food we eat, especially here in the United States, creates free radicals that cause us to age and in some cases cause illness, some of which are deadly. Now, for the first time in history, there's a supplement called Protandim that is listed on the U.S. government's PubMed.gov website with many peer-reviewed studies all showing that Protandim is a proven killer of the free radicals that are aging and in some cases even killing us. Now, I'm not talking about killing one molecule of free radical per one molecule of antioxidants like the stuff we've been taking. I'm talking about killing 1 million free radicals per second, per molecule, and this is the very same antioxidant your own body produces. Protandim supercharges your body to create much more than it does without Protandim. There's an old saying that we are warned about in the scriptures. That's the attitude, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. So let me ask you, how much money do you spend on food a day? If you're out shopping or at the beach, would you think anything of spending a buck or even more on a can of soda? If there was a vending machine that sold something that killed what was aging you or even killing you, would you even hesitate to spend a buck and a half a day? Well, now there is such a vending machine, and it's sitting right in front of you. It's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now.
So that might be interesting for listeners. Just a few other developments. I mentioned that Paul Benson, who presided over the original trial, he passed away on April 22nd of 2004. And the way the Freedom of Information Act works is once a person is deceased, their records are fair game. And I have FOIA requests pending for any records relating to Paul Benson, because there's no doubt that there was a great chance or possibility that there were improper communications between the FBI and the late Judge Benson during the course of Leonard Peltier's trial. Douglas Durham, the informant who had infiltrated AIM, he passed away in February of this year, and efforts are being made to secure his file under Freedom of Information Act to see what might be in that dossier. Additionally, Marlon Brando, who passed away in July of this year, was a big supporter of the American Indian Movement and Leonard Peltier. And we already received, for example, from the Chicago file, we received a memorandum. Well, actually, they called it an airtel. It's dated August 7th, 1975. And shortly, this would have been, a little over a month and a half after the firefight at Pine Ridge. There was a Sundance being held at Rosebud, South Dakota. And the FBI, of course, had informants at this Sundance. And they were very interested in the fact that Marlon Brando was there. And if I may, I'd like to read one paragraph.
Sure.
This is from page 3 of the airtel. It says, "One night, former actor Marlon Brando was present, flying in via private jet to airstrip at Mission, South Dakota, and leaving the next day. Brando mingled with Means," meaning Russell Means, "Swift Talk, Tyon, and Bellacourt, that's Clyde Bellacourt, got drunk and seemed primarily interested in having sexual relations with young Indian girls, several of whom were supplied to him. His appearance was described as," and this is in quotation marks, "looking like a bum. I mean, this is this is your FBI at work. I mean, to me, it's just incredible.
People wonder why, born and raised, died of the wool conservatives like me, become liberals. You know, they think we can't see through all this crap.
No, it's. Yeah. I mean, this is the J. Edgar Hooverism.
Oh yeah.
They were just looking on dirt, and if you read throughout this teletype, there's another comment. Swift Talk stated that AIM, or the American Indian Movement, is helping Patty Hearst, and then they got some things about the AIM burning down Catholic churches, and
it's
hysteria.
Well, we all know about what a man of experience J. Edgar was.
Oh, I know it. So, I'm very intrigued to see what's in the Brando file.
Yeah.
In fact, while before Leonard was apprehended in Canada, a motorhome was stopped in Oregon in November of 75, and that motorhome was owned by Marlon Brando. So the FBI really was out to get him, and they were going to use any method at their disposal to do just that.
That's incredible. Land of the free and home of the brave, you know.
But the I had mentioned this Black Horse character, and just to give you a little history of this Frank Black Horse, whose name was actually Frank DeLuca. He's March 11th, 1973. Black Horse is accused of shooting FBI Special Agent Curtis Fitzgerald in Wounded Knee, South Dakota. August 29th, 73, Black Horse is indicted by a federal grand jury for shooting Special Agent Fitzgerald. So June 26, 75, Kohler and Williams are killed in the firefight. July 3rd, 1975, an individual by the name of Dale Lewis Shepard purchases a 12-gauge Remington shotgun that was taken from Agent Kohler's at the time of his death. This Mr. Shepard buys the shotgun for $15 from an individual resembling Black Horse. July 17th, 1975, that's a little over 2 weeks after the firefight, there's an FBI teletype from Rapid City to the FBI director, and it specifically states that the investigation of the deaths of Special Agents Kohler and Williams was being directed towards developing information into locking Peltier and Black Horse into the case. And it's just amazing. Here's a guy, turns up, he's shooting, wounds an agent, turns up again where two agents end up dead, and he's allowed to roam around Western Canada, never faces a day in jail in the States.
Isn't that interesting? It makes you wonder who he was.
Yeah, well, he's Frank Leonard DeLuca. And what's also intriguing is he had a history of arrests. He kept getting arrested and let go. He was wanted also in Wisconsin for carrying a concealed weapon and obstructing an officer. Now, he's arrested in Canada. Black Horse is arrested February 6, 1976. 3 short days later, the DA in Wisconsin, a Richard Stadelman, advises the FBI that the charges pending against Black Horse would be formally dropped. And the other intriguing thing is Black Horse, he's never brought back for a trial, even on the shooting of Special Agent Fitzgerald. But guess who goes to trial? The woman assigned to represent Black Horse. The government came down on her. If there's a case, it's called In Regard to Grand Jury Proceedings, Des Moines, Iowa. It's for those of the those listeners who actually read these federal court decisions, it's at volume 568, Federal Reporter, second series, page 555. It's a 1977 case out of the 8th Circuit. But a woman by the name of Martha Koppelman, was an attorney. She was a young, idealistic attorney. She was working with an organization called the Wounded Knee Legal Defense Offense Committee, or WICLDOC for short. She was assigned to represent Black Horse in this upcoming trial for shooting Special Agent Fitzgerald. Black Horse never shows up for the trial. The government doesn't really care about Black Horse, but they try to hammer Ms. Kopelman for allegedly not telling Black Horse that he had a trial date. She was put through a 3-year ordeal.
Oh, wow.
Very intriguing. Now,
see, he was like number 5 on the FBI's original suspect list too.
Yeah, he was. I don't know what position he held in that regard, but the guy did a lot of damage, and that's usually what happens with these undercover agents or informants. They get in organizations, sort of get the ball rolling.
Yeah,
they'll encourage other people to engage in illegal or unlawful activity.
We call them provocateurs.
Yes, and then they exit stage left while the police come in and make the start making the arrest and cracking heads open. But the Wounded Knee Legal Defense Offense Committee, just as an aside, was a group of attorneys and legal workers who came to South Dakota to help Aboriginal people. And one document we got under the Freedom of Information Act, which was very intriguing, it revealed that on June 30th, 1973, several agents rented an apartment, actually apartment number 306 at 4101 Lakeview Drive in Rapid City, South Dakota. And the FBI claimed, of course, these agents were all just good buddies and roommates. And it just so happened that apartment 306 had a common wall with an apartment rented by individuals associated with the Wounded Knee Legal Defense Offense Committee. But they said that was a coincidence, and there was no type of improper surveillance or anything of that nature occurring. Of course I believe that, as I bet your listeners do, too. So I think if you look at Leonard's case, it appears to me, my theory is, my firm belief is that this was a classic case of the FBI's counterintelligence program gone awry. And for your listeners who don't know what the counterintelligence program is or was, it was a vigilante program run by the FBI. It was, in fact, the Dirty Tricks program, and it was used to harass targeted individuals and organizations. The FBI would use things such as harassment, arrest, snitch jacketing, and that's a procedure where the FBI or their operatives label a targeted individual as being an informant when in fact he or she isn't. They would use poison pen letters. They would contact employers. They would spread rumors, anything they could to disrupt the targeted individual or organization. All right. So what I believe the FOIA documents will reveal in Leonard Peltier's case is that he was a victim of the counterintelligence program, and that firefighting that was a case of COINTELPRO gone awry.
Yeah.
I think their agents such as Durham and this Black Horse character sort of got the wheels in motion, and things went terribly wrong, and as a result, Joe Stuntz and Agents Kohler and Williams lost their lives because of this criminal program, which was run. They claim it's defunct. I don't believe it. I think it's just called something else, but I think as a result of COINTELPRO activities, you had the organization destroyed, and numerous people lost their lives as a result. And I'm going to
work
overtime to pry loose every last document from the FBI to expose this program and to expose this grave injustice that's been perpetrated against Leonard Peltier and the American Indian Movement. And just recently, the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals recognized in November of last year, 2003, the government, or the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals stated this: much of the government's behavior at the Pine Ridge Reservation and in its prosecution of Mr. Peltier is to be condemned. The government withheld evidence. It intimidated witnesses. These facts are not disputed. So the courts have recognized there's been a great injustice in Leonard Peltier's case, and I think the reason the government is fighting so hard to keep these files from Leonard Peltier and his attorneys is because you know, it would just show how criminal this agency was, and how it was just hell bent on using anything at its disposal to set up Leonard Peltier.
Mm-hmm. A Tenth Circuit, is that out of San Francisco or Salt Lake?
No, Tenth Circuit is in Denver, Colorado.
Oh, Denver, okay.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
Wow, it's nonstop energy. Well, I cannot even imagine. And just for example, last night, you did a show last night that was 90 minutes starting at 7:30.
That's right.
Then you went through that. Then you came here. You're here this morning.
That's right.
Doing all of this.
It's nonstop. I don't sleep anymore.
No. All right, so where do you get the energy? Seriously, I mean, look at you.
Well,
I mean, we've known each other a long time. Yeah. We've passed. You don't ever get older.
Well, thank you. It's quite funny because, you know, people are kind of shocked when they hear that I'm 54 years old, and they say, how do you keep your youth? I have found something, Dr. Phil, that I think is the closest thing to the fountain of youth.
Oh, you do have a secret.
I have a secret, and I've never really talked about it. Well, I've been doing this for the last 2 years. It's called Protandem, and it works. And I'm telling everybody about this.
You feel differently.
I do.
Because you're running around like a chicken with your head cut off.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you're hitting the times. You're getting where you're supposed to be.
I have to be on the spot all the time.
Now, I've got three sisters, and we get along great 1,500 miles apart. I cannot imagine.
It takes me 1,600 miles.
Yeah, but I can't imagine working with my sister every day. What do you do when you have disagreements? Because you have to have disagreements, right? Because you're both producers.
Yeah, we're both producers, and that's difficult because we're both type A. And you're going to butt heads. What's really interesting about the Donnie Marie duo is that it doesn't really matter how much we butt the heads when that curtain goes.
It's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now.
Yeah, well, so you can't accuse them of being too liberal.
No. It's anything but that. But what's incredible is the court in that case, and for people like actually looking these up. A lot of the cases, you know, all the appellate courts now have websites, and you can actually, you know, whether it be the Tenth Circuit or the Second Circuit here in New York, you can pull these decisions up online. But that case where that I just quoted from, it's Peltier versus Booker, and that's 348 Federal Reporter 3rd Series, and it's at page 888, and that precise language is at page 896. But it's just amazing that the court recognized all this, but nevertheless the court didn't render a decision in Leonard Peltier's favor. Which is criminal in and of itself.
Yeah. Well, you know, no wonder the world looks at America and, you know, and says, you know, what hypocrites. You know, the United States likes to go all over the world pointing out human rights violations and won't clean up its own backyard. It's incredible. And it's because of the it's probably about money. Yeah, because they know if Leonard got out, he'd probably sue the federal government out of existence.
Well, I mean, that wouldn't be an easy process, but I think that's also a concern that once he's released, that there'd be civil suits brought. I mean, it happened in the case of Geronimo Pratt. He was a member of the Black Panther Party, who was set up for a crime he did not commit in Santa Monica, California. And he was vindicated a few years ago, and he ended up suing the FBI and the Los Angeles Police Department and got a sizable out-of-court settlement.
They had enough evidence that the government let it go forward.
Yeah, well, in Geronimo Pratt's case, he was a, you know, much like Leonard Peltier was, you know, he was involved with the Black Panther Party, was a respected member. He was actually at a meeting in the Bay Area, FBI surveillance logs, which turned up missing, confirmed that he was in the Bay Area when these murders, they were, I believe, called the tennis court shooting. It was a husband-wife team. The wife was killed at a Santa Monica tennis court, and Geronimo Pratt was set up for that murder. And, you know, there was a same thing as in Leonard's case. Documents were withheld, things turned up missing and such, and Geronimo Pratt, you know, embarked on a 20-some-odd-year battle to receive justice. There's actually a great book by his defense attorney, I believe it's The Last Man Standing, and it shows how Geronimo Pratt used the Freedom of Information Act to ultimately secure his freedom from the California state prison system. But for folks who are interested in learning more about Leonard Peltier's case, there's two websites that people can visit. There's leonardpeltier.org. And for those who don't know how to spell Peltier, it's P-E-L-T-I-E-R. There's also freepeltier.org. And either site will give you an update on, you know, current events and what's happening in Leonard Peltier's case.
And the page that all the people have to do to listen to this interview is simply to come to a web page, and that web page also has links we'll have these links up on there also.
Yeah, they'll
permanently archived.
Yeah, and if you use any of the search engines and type in Leonard Peltier, I mean, he has support groups around the country and the world. I mean, you just type in Leonard Peltier and you'll get thousands of hits. So there's a lot happening. I'm very optimistic. Barry Bacharach, one of the other attorneys, recently filed suit on Leonard Peltier's behalf and Yori Von Kahl's behalf. Yori is also in Leavenworth, and they're suing the Parole Commission, claiming that, and the basis of the suit is that both Leonard and Yori Von Kahl should have been released, that the Parole Commission is violating the law and not giving both Yori and Leonard definite release dates. So there's a lot of positive things happening. I'll probably here in Buffalo be bringing some new FOIA suits and just, you know, keeping the pressure on and coming on programs such as yours. And once again, on behalf of Leonard and myself, I'd like to thank you for having me.
Absolutely.
And you know, just to get the word out, there's a lot of young people weren't even born when the shootout at Pine Ridge occurred.
Yeah.
So we have to get the young people up to speed. And
going up to 30 years now, that's a generation and a half.
Yeah, that's, let's see, yeah, 70, firefight was June of 75. February 6th, yeah, it'll be, what, the
29 and a half years.
Yeah, 29th anniversary of his apprehension in Canada.
Just incredible. Well, we sure appreciate you, Mike. Prayers are with you and the rest of the defense team, especially with Leonard. I know everybody really enjoys Leonard's art and his spirit. Is he still in a lot of pain, or are they helping him any more with his mouth and everything?
Well, Leonard celebrated his 60th birthday on September 12th. I mean, he's not a kid anymore, and it's my understanding, you know, the median age, for an Aboriginal person is like 45. I mean, he's already beaten the odds.
Yeah.
And being in any prison, whether it's Leavenworth, Attica, or whatever, is no picnic. It's I know he's had a problem with heel spurs and such, and you know, life isn't easy in the prison at Leavenworth.
Yeah. That sure isn't. Well, Mike.
But I know Leonard appreciates all the support he gets, all the letters people have written to him and on his behalf, and he wants people not to forget about him and to keep up the good fight. And, you know, I haven't seen him since May, but we're all very optimistic about some of the latest things we're doing on the legal front, and I know I'm going to fight like hell to see that the public spotlight is kept on this terrible injustice, and I don't plan to give up, and I hope your listeners continue to help out, and it's truly appreciated on this end, and from all the other attorneys involved, and last but not least, Leonard Peltier. He loves you all, and thanks you from the bottom of his heart.
Before you go, Mike, what kind of privileges does he have in his cell? Is he allowed any audio equipment?
To be quite honest, I'm not certain. They have a new warden. I don't know how. It's still too early to tell. It's not like you can just mail things in. I mean, if you go to the Bureau of Prison website, say, they have a you know, a section there for, you know, what programs are available, do's and don'ts, if you will.
Yeah, I was wondering if he might have a tape player or a CD player in his cell.
I don't know if he has that, but I don't doubt that the guys have access or are able. I mean, he keeps abreast of current events and such.
I was wondering how we could get, because we you know, we generate, you know, 1.5, 2 hours, sometimes 3 hours a week of interviews. We're up to about 60 hours of listening here, that's available for free on the website. I was wondering how we could go about getting this into his cell or to a cell near him.
I know the guys were listening to Democracy Now! Because Leavenworth is about 20 minutes west of the airport there in Kansas City. I forget, there was something where they either changed the broadcast time or something which made it more difficult, or if not impossible, for the guys to hear, you know, Amy Goodman and
radio
and the program.
Yeah, they're just able to get radio.
So I'm not sure what they can and can't do. He might have access to a tape player or CD, but I'm not certain.
Okay, all right.
I mean, the worst they could do is reject it.
Yeah. Well, maybe we can figure out a way to get him, because I know. I know the guys would probably enjoy hearing what we're doing, because we, you know, Leonard's teacher, Rolling Thunder, has walked west. Now he walked west in '97, and he considered Rolling Thunder to be his medicine man. And but there's some other great ones that come up behind him, and they're dying off too. And anyway, that's what we could do to comfort him. Well. This has been Mike Kuzma on Prophecy Keepers Radio, and we sure appreciate you, Mike. We'll keep in touch, and I found your photograph, and I found some information. We'll get up a permanent page. The address for this page will be prophecykeepers.com/kuzma.html,
okay.
And it'll be permanently archived.
Okay, great. That's fine, and as soon as Judge Scretany renders the decision, I'll make sure the word gets out, and everybody knows what the good judge had to say.
Excellent. Well, thanks a lot, Mike.
Okay. Have a great evening.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. This station's only means of support is through donations and purchases of the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library, which includes lifetime online access to a printable 1,000-page intelligence briefing and a worldwide indigenous prophecy encyclopedia. Now, folks, there's nothing else like this collection on the planet. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library. 3,287 files and 222 folders. It includes the Prophecy Keepers Preppers Self-Reliance files and all of our previous over 100 Prophecy Keepers interviews. So head on over to prophecykeepers.com right now and have a free sneak peek today of two-thirds of the Prophecy Keepers trilogy and a peek of the dashboard of the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault.
Good afternoon. These are on, I presume. I'd like to talk to you today, and do I have control of these slides, or is I do? Okay. Let's get through these really quick, because this is just because you have to get CMEs, and I have to tell you that I am on the Speakers Bureau for GSK, GlaxoSmithKline, and also a nutritional consultant for an HIV nutritional company named Biosource Therapeutics, which has nothing to do with what I'm talking about today. What I'd like to talk to you about is something that I find thoroughly fascinating. It is glutathione. It is one of the four endogenous antioxidants, and it is one that I must admit, despite 80,000 published articles in the English literature, through medical school, internship, residency, fellowship, and a fairly long time in academic medicine, I knew nothing about. It is a very interesting molecule because it exists in an accelerated or increased energy state. The energy state is, or increased energy state, is caused by the fact that it's got a free sulfhydryl group and therefore can easily donate the hydrogen to a electron and therefore quench a free radical. Now, let me tell you, because I think it's important, and it is a little bit of a divergence, but I learned about glutathione because of something that you probably all have seen in your practice, and that is a low uric acid. Now, when I was in medical school and when I was a professor of oncology, the only thing I knew about uric acid is when you had a kid that you were going to treat for leukemia, you put him on allopurinol to keep the uric acid down. I knew nothing about uric acid being low, except it kept appearing, and it appeared in about 20% of my patients, and that just didn't make sense. So I finally went into PubMed, and after stumbling around for a long time, I found out that uric acid is the last antioxidant your body uses when it's run out of everything else. When it's run out of gas, okay, it uses uric acid. Interesting. So if that's the last, the question then, what was the first? And that is where I got into glutathione. I've been coming to some of these meetings for a while, and glutathione is very important for a number of things, not all of which I'm going to go into today. But in point of fact, it has a great deal to do with not only well-being, okay, but aging well, or if you will, retarding the aging process. So I think it's very applicable. I'd like to, at the risk of repeating things that you already know, go over some of the things that glutathione is important about. Alone in the antioxidant world, okay, every other antioxidant, when it becomes oxidized, becomes itself a free radical. Glutathione doesn't. It actually recycles other antioxidants. In fact, the body considers it so important that up to 6% of the entire ATP expenditure or energy expenditure of the body may be used to synthesize and optimize glutathione levels. That's pretty impressive, 6% of the entire energy output of the body. It is also the only non-enzyme antioxidant that doesn't become a free radical and, in fact, has a very interesting corollary when it becomes oxidized, because what happens is it complexes to another spent glutathione molecule, and the compound then becomes GSSG, and GSSG has been shown in animal studies at least to promote and induce delta wave sleep. We all know the importance of that in terms of the aging process, so this, even in its used-up form, functions as a very useful product. It not only functions as an antioxidant itself, but alone again in the world of antioxidants, it is an absolutely essential component of antioxidant enzymes, namely glutathione peroxidase, and most importantly, the glutathione transferases. And I bring that up because glutathione transferase abnormalities have now been associated with virtually every cancer known to man, and probably with a lot more than that. And therefore, by promoting the production of glutathione transferases through improving glutathione, we may be doing even more than I'm able to talk about right now. In addition, if that were not enough, let's keep going. It's a chelator. In fact, it's 50% as effective as oral chelation in getting rid of mercury. It has an effect on other heavy metals, but they're not as pronounced as mercury, and mercury is pretty ubiquitous in an environment, so it kind of comes as a freebie. And it detoxifies organic pollutants, perhaps the best known one of which is the 2-carbon fragment that we know as alcohol. And in fact, without glutathione, you ultimately get a hangover because you stop the process at acetaldehyde, which is phase one detox, and that in itself is a free radical. And obviously, many of us may have felt the effects of that if we didn't have enough glutathione. Now, why is it important in aging? Well, these are old data, and I think they're probably not as robust as they should be, but I'll give you what is available now. Glutathione levels decrease with age. The data would suggest it's 1% a year beginning in the 20s. I think that's too little, too late, but that's only my opinion right now. I haven't proved it. There are some very interesting things, though. Age-matched normals, okay, reveal that anybody at, say, 45 who's had his first heart attack or has asthma or whatever other disease you want to use has a lower glutathione level than somebody of that age who's well. So disease causes decrease in glutathione and an accelerated decrease compared to normals. Glutathione happens to be, and this is perhaps the take-home message, it's the major protector of mitochondrial DNA. Mitochondrial DNA is that DNA within the cells that's responsible, if you will, for the electron transport chain that produces every bit of energy in your body. And we know from pathologic data that if you take a biopsy from a 90-year-old and compare it to a biopsy in a 5-year-old, the mitochondrial DNA in the 90-year-old is only 5% normal compared to the 5-year-old. So obviously we destroy our mitochondrial DNA, we destroy our energy, and we age. Maintenance of normal mitochondrial DNA is directly correlated, and it's got an R value above 9.9, with aging. So the higher your glutathione, the less you age. And I think
it's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now.
Thank you.